listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. And this week we're here in Lent 5, where we have some wonderful readings that talk about the complete hopelessness and of utter death and destruction, but also give us images of recreation, new life, rebirth. And I'm talking here about particularly Ezekiel 37, verses 1 to 14, and the John 11 passage, which is the raising of Lazarus. So two very strong and vivid texts that we're going to be discussing today.
And we're very fortunate to have with us Dr. Liz Bowes. Welcome, Liz.
Thank you.
Liz is the Dean of the School of Graduate Research at the University of Divinity, and she's also a Hebrew scholar. Liz, I'm wondering whether you could tell us a bit about the focus of your research at the moment.
Okay. So at the moment I'm working in the area of trauma theory, so basically looking at contemporary understandings of the impact of trauma on individuals, but in my case particularly on communities. Mm. The way that trauma gets expressed, particularly in literary texts, which of course is relevant for the biblical text, and then the way that communities work through their traumatic experiences, and the way that text can help to facilitate that sense of meaning making on the other side of a crisis. So particularly at the moment I'm working on Jeremiah, closely related to the book of Ezekiel, and experimenting a bit on how different theories of trauma, whether it's cultural theories, literary theories, sociological, psychological, that if we apply each one of those in different ways to texts, what kind of insights do we see? Really looking at the way that much of the Hebrew Bible, and particularly when we're talking about the prophetic literature, is dealing with times of deep change and often quite catastrophic situations, and then to reconsider those texts not so much as predictive texts of this is what God's about to do to you, but looking on the other side of that crisis and how those how that prophetic literature helps the community to come to terms with the crisis and to express what's happened to them.
Right.
Which takes us perfectly into Ezekiel.
Yep, absolutely.
So let's go right there, and it's no accident that you're our guest today with this text. Liz, give us a little bit of the context. What's going on in Ezekiel's world, you know, historically at this time?
Okay. So Ezekiel's a particularly weird text. It's a bit like Daniel and Revelation. It's kind of out there in some of the imagery.
That's why I love it.
Yeah, it's a strange text. But if you understand the historical context, it actually begins to make sense. So Ezekiel was written in the period around what we refer to as the Babylonian exile, probably began after 597 BCE. So we often only think of one exilic experience, but there are actually multiple periods of exile. Yeah. The first one occurred around 597, and a group of leading citizens were taken off to Babylon in response to the leaders of Jerusalem rebelling against the Babylonians. They weren't happy about it, so they came in. They didn't destroy the city at that stage, but took a group of people off into exile. Ezekiel seems to have been amongst those who went off into exile. So he was away from home, away from all the familiarities of temple, of social structure in a foreign land. The dialogue that seems to have been pretty prevalent at that time, and we know from both Ezekiel and Jeremiah, is that the assumption was the worst had happened, that a group of people had been deported, and that from here on life would go back to normal and stability, that the people in exile would return home soon, and that was the end of the threat from Babylon. Both Ezekiel and Jeremiah were in fact giving a different message, or the book as we have it now portrays a different message, because historically we know that 10 years later, Jerusalem was destroyed, and you know, a lot more people were taken off into exile. So Ezekiel's framing and straddling between the first exile and then the major exile that happened 10 years later. His writings are framed as being largely predictive, although, as I said before, I think we have a lot more benefit from reading the prophets, whatever their origins, as understanding them as written texts after the event that then look back on what's happened. So he's really struggling with this sense of crisis, of this breakdown of community identity, and trying to come to terms with where God fits in the midst of that chaotic situation.
And finding reason for it. I mean, I think Ezekiel's a priest, or presented as that way in the text, and you know, one of the things that's quite vivid, not in our particular passage, is he's very condemnatory of some of the practices going on in the temple, that there's idolatry, that people have strayed. And of course, that's all a way to make sense of why God would let this temple, which is the house of God, be destroyed.
And that's a really strong thread through Ezekiel, through Jeremiah, and in fact through much of the prophetic literature, is that the kind of, as one scholar refers to it, as God's absolute no that comes through in the prophetic literature makes a lot more sense if we see it in terms of interpreting what's already happened, that there is whatever the origins of the prophetic speech, and you know, I think I'm reasonably comfortable with saying that the prophetic figures have a historical entity behind them, that they were out there speaking, but I think it's unlikely that anything quite as negative and condemnatory would have had any chance of being heard in that kind of really strong form that we have it in now. But if you think about what typically happens after an event where you're trying to find reasons for something happening, then it's often that kind of blame game that you play. And you know, we see it now in contemporary victims of let's say, you know, a common assault as you're walking down the street. If only I hadn't done such and such. So we get that kind of language that comes through really strongly in the prophetic literature. And it's almost as if a bad explanation is better than no explanation, because if you've got a reason, then hopefully you can do something to control that in the future.
Yes, it's a very human response.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm reminded of Job and his friends.
Yes.
And also the passage last week about the man born blind, where they came up with all sorts of, you must have done something wrong. If you didn't do something wrong, your parents would have done something.
Exactly, yes. So that's a case of blaming the victim. But victims themselves often do that blaming. So other people can, because that makes you feel safer. But victims will also
take that on
as a way of actually trying to control the future.
Yes.
So some of the language we see in the prophets, not necessarily here in Ezekiel 37, but in other places of, you know, if you go back to the covenant, if you worship only God, if you do X, Y, and Z, then you will be restored, actually feeds into that kind of sense of needing to have agency and control
bargaining.
Of the future. I don't know if it's bargaining. I think it's more around having a sense of control and agency. When everything in your world's fallen apart, to end up in a personal space or a theological space where it's all just random acts that you have no control about leaves you in a sense of helplessness. But being able to regain a sense of agency and control, you are more likely to be able to move forward. Now, it may mean that you have to revise your thinking and, you know, in contemporary context, here comes therapy. But, you know, you would hope in this kind of social context that it ultimately there is some kind of revision, which actually I think the book of Job is. You know, it questions that.
Yes, it challenges.
It doesn't endorse it at all.
That's right.
So I think Job's a response to the kind of theology that comes into play in the prophets and in the Deuteronomistic history, that you know, that answer may have helped you at that point in time, but we're in a different time now,
yeah.
and it's time to move on and to move forward.
Yeah. So let's all bring this down to chapter 37 of Ezekiel. Yeah. What do we need to, what images strike you? What do we need to know about this text to unpack what's going on here?
Okay. So we begin with this kind of vision that Ezekiel is taken to, and Ezekiel's full of visionary experiences. And this is probably one of the least bizarre ones in the sense that we can imagine there is some kind of historical reality behind this. The image of a valley full of dry bones is quite in line with what we know about ancient warfare practices, that there would have been high death rates, there would have been slaughter.
Bodies left on the field,
which is actually an ultimate kind of humiliation.
Yes.
Because bodies were so revered that they were buried and they were treated respectfully. So to have a valley full of dry bones is a sign of utter defeat and humiliation.
And
so
no one left to bury them, presumably.
No one left to bury them, I think, is part of it. Mm. That total humiliation, but the sense of the extent of the death and destruction as well. So Ezekiel is looking over this valley of dried bones and all that represents. And the question from God, can these bones live? I haven't got the text in front of me. Yep. What's the exact wording?
Mortal, can these bones live?
Yes.
Or son of man, depending how we translate that funny word.
Yep.
Set of words.
And Ezekiel's response is quite ambiguous. Oh, Lord, you know. Well, is that saying, you know they can't, or?
Or only you know.
Only you know.
I took it to be only you know.
Yeah, possibly. But I think it's actually quite ambiguous. So I think most people would translate it as only you know, which actually then highlights that this is God's act. This is what God is doing here.
Yes.
Whichever way we translate that within this passage, this is only God that can act in this situation. And there isn't a sense of conditionality here.
There is or there isn't?
Prophesy to these bones is all he's told.
Yes.
And say to them, O dry bones, hear the word of the Lord.
Yes. So this is in fact, I think this whole passage has echoes of Genesis 1.
Yes.
So the God does by command. Actually, probably also Genesis 2 as well.
So both creation stories
begin to fold in here. The word ruach, wind, occurs seven times throughout this passage.
Yeah,
so it's a
everywhere.
Really strong emphasis, sometimes breath, sometimes wind.
You wouldn't translate that spirit?
Yes, you can.
Could, yeah. Yes.
However, not spirit, capital S, Trinitarian God, but that sense of God as the creative.
God's breath.
God's animating life force, life-giving, life-generative presence that brings renewal into this.
Is that the same word in John 20:22, where he breathed on them and said to them, receive the Holy Spirit?
Well, it's similar if we compared the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Of course, we're talking about the ruach in the Hebrew, which ends up being pneuma.
Yeah.
So it is that breathing,
same
God's
idea.
Pneuma, God's breath.
Mm. Just consistent from Genesis 3.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that idea that we're not just bones and muscles and things, that actually we are only animated as fully human when we have this spirit of God, this breath of God.
Absolutely. So this is a transforming action of God that brings a sense of renewal out of this deep sense of utter hopelessness. Mm. By the time we get to verse 11, we are clearly in allegorical ground here. It doesn't remain as a vision, but it in fact begins to be interpreted so that the bones represent not the dead people, but the whole house of Israel. Mm. So this actually becomes a vision for a renewal of the people, a renewal of the nation. I would hesitate to plonk this purely as a resurrection imagery.
Yes.
In fact, I wouldn't go down that path. And I think to preach this as resurrection as such is contradictory to the Hebrew scriptures and to the kinds of issues that were beginning to emerge at the time of Jesus, where the whole question of the bodily resurrection was still being worked out.
And that comes very late into Judaism.
Absolutely.
Any hint of there being a resurrection in Daniel for the first time. So if I'm hearing you correctly, there's an appeal here to, like, even though these are life-renewing images or death-to-life images, to be a bit careful about the language we use.
Absolutely, yeah.
And in that sense, it's probably distinct to the John 11 passage, although there again – there's resurrection, but it's different to Jesus' resurrection.
Well, it's not
resurrection.
Jesus' resurrection, no. So Lazarus will die again.
Lazarus is raised to, one assumes, continue in human existence, but that doesn't mean he'll, yeah. Mm. So, it's not as simple as saying these are all, they're precursors to Jesus' resurrection and to Easter, but in different ways.
I think so. So, and from verse 11 onwards really situates this as a message for a community who has utterly lost hope, who is at that point of thinking this is the end of who we are. This is the end of our relationship with God. There is no way forward. We have no hope. And so this vision of Ezekiel that moves into then an allegory is a way of saying, even in the midst of what seems like utter death, God's spirit, God's breath can bring renewal and transformation into that situation.
Mm. Creation from nothing again.
Yes, yeah. And which is, of course, a really strong pattern that we see throughout, throughout Genesis and into Exodus, chaos, disorder, seeming null and void, and then God moves into that situation again and brings this renewed cycle of new creation. So in a sense, it's and significantly in Ezekiel, he then goes on to talk about the rebuilding of the temple, which has very strong echoes back to the Exodus language around the building of the temple as well. So which is an act of God's new creation.
And, I mean, it struck me too, I looked up Robert Alter's translation of the Old Testament, and in verse 10 he talks about, when they all came to life and they stood on their feet, this great multitude, and he says a very, very great legion, which of course, and the Hebrew word is army or can mean that. But it struck me the militaristic.
Yes.
There is a sense of a nation restored, and a nation restored includes its army restored so that those foreigners can't come and invade you.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, so it is nationalistic. It's a return to
Absolutely.
Land with force, with grandeur.
But it hasn't started yet is the other thing. So one of the oddities is often biblically when we get this sense of new life coming in, there's joy and celebration and dancing. But here there isn't. They are simply standing, waiting to see what happens next. So it's not, we're on our feet, we're going off to defeat the Babylonians, but they are standing and waiting. So there is an expectation that there is more to come from here, I think.
Yep. The other thing that struck me at the end here where this passage finishes, we've already had very similar refrains twice in Ezekiel, in the chapter just before and back in chapter 11, of this promise of God, I'll put a new heart in you, a new spirit in you, you'll live in the land, I will be your God. I mean, this becomes a refrain in Ezekiel and similar things in other prophets.
Yep, particularly in Jeremiah.
It's a way of talking about restoration, I think.
Yeah, a renewal of covenant, that language of a new heart is very much covenant language, which links us to today's psalm, sense of God, of covenant being initiated by God. So it's God who puts the new heart in the people. Which actually then echoes the initial covenant, I will be your God, you will be my people, which is, if we think back to Exodus, is initiated by God. It's a movement of God towards the people. And so this imagery of renewed covenant, renewed heart is actually, again, an act of God moving back, returning literally. You know, that really powerful Hebrew word shuv, to, you know, to reorient or to turning back or to return to, which kind of captures this dynamic two-way relationship between the people of God and God, that it is a movement, it's dynamic, and that both God and people can make that movement. And of course we see that in the psalm. The psalmist cries out to God that there is a sense of loss, of pain, of struggle. Often in the psalms we get the feeling of God's absence. But it's not a passive acceptance. It's a, you know, we're in a relationship with each other, and I'm back at you, God. I'm here to struggle with you and call out to you, because I actually think that you are there and powerful and able to act. And
that comes through very strongly in that psalm, that it's a despair of the sort, but there's a confidence that God's forgiveness is actually all there.
Absolutely.
Yes. Which strikes me as an important point to make in Lent 5, well, any day of the year. But, we're in Lent 5, the season of Lent, being reminded of our covenant, or of God's covenant with us, and our call to turn, or shuv, as you were saying. Important to point out.
Mm. Yeah, and that this, I mean, in both the psalm and Ezekiel, it is God's action, as we've said. It's communal.
Yes, very much.
It's beyond the individual, but it's also not dependent on you having been good in like in the psalm. It's explicit, like regardless of your iniquities, God will redeem. Yeah.
Yes, and I think that comes through in Ezekiel, that it is a movement of God,
divine initiative.
Yeah,
human interaction.
Yep.
Mm. How does this link in with the John passage then, Fran? Do you want to say anything?
Well,
I mean,
I would just make perhaps a fairly clear connection in the depth of the despair and the deadliness of the death. So we have Lazarus has been in the tomb for 4 days and smells.
Yeah, which is another way of describing the utter death. Totally dead.
I think there's, this is not connected to Ezekiel necessarily, but the portrayal of Jesus' response, Jesus wept.
Yes.
I think I've heard a sermon on just those words that might, you know, what are the implications of that? And Jesus' anger and despair along with his friends that this is the situation that's happening. So I think also it's an example of the power of God to bring life from utter impossibility. I'm not sure there's as much, well, Jesus is the one who does the miracle. I'm not sure there's as much human interaction apart from despair and shock.
Yeah, but there's faith. Yeah. There's Mary and Martha both say something along the lines of, if you'd been here, this wouldn't have happened. Or, you know, I believe you can, you know, there is faith that Jesus' presence changes things. Acknowledgement.
And I think connected to last week. So last week the man born blind was made to see by Jesus, and this got threats. Threats are increasing against Jesus, and this is the straw that breaks the camel's back. They now look for his death, for the one who brings life will die.
So how do we preach these texts? We can turn to our contemporary context. And I'm wondering, Liz, in particular, if we think of any of these texts through a kind of a trauma lens, how might that change either the questions we ask or the way we speak? Connecting in a contemporary way. I mean, it occurred to me that we can be playful. Ezekiel's images made total sense in his time.
Absolutely.
And talking about bones, we get this language in the Psalms that bones are, your inner deep parts. But we might use different images today to describe what is both utter destruction and total death and then new life. But let's come back to the trauma question. Is there?
Yep. I think particularly resting in both of these Hebrew scripture passages is that disconnect here, that this isn't about sinfulness, although the larger context of Ezekiel clearly that comes in. But that sense that even in the depths of the dark places or the dry places or the barren places, that it is the spirit, the breath of God reanimating and recreating, renewing that then brings hope and life. Because ultimately both these passages are utterly hopeful.
Yeah, I was going to say they are.
They are.
Profoundly hopeful.
Profoundly hopeful, yeah. So where are the kind of dry places in our world? And in an Australian context, there are some obvious, you know,
yes,
the droughts and the bushfires. Yeah. I think even, you know, in this context that we're facing at the moment, the kind of fear of pandemic and anxiousness that somehow our social structures might break down, you know, mass buying toilet paper and all things.
And in all of those contemporary situations, we are doing the same thing Ezekiel's doing, which is looking for reasons and explanation and finding ways to try and control.
Yes.
So perhaps and naming that human instinct.
Absolutely. It is what we do when we're faced with something unknown. But I think in the end that the meaning making is work, that we can't, the bizarreness of Ezekiel is about meaning making. And then it is as we are open to the presence of God in the frightening, dark, scary places that actually that spirit moves in and brings a sense of transformation and renewal and hope. But we need to be open to those. Ezekiel had to accept the vision. The psalmist was open to this covenant relationship with God. And so there is that creating the space for that renewal of God's
God's
trust. Spirit.
I think if I could, I would also say that part of the despair is the despair that that's not true.
Or the fear?
Well, the fear that this is all not true. So something about preaching that the community believes this for you, if you're in a place now where this is rubbish, that we're here to believe this with you, and the tradition has given, as Brueggemann says, us this prophetic imagination that is like an earthquake that cracks what you think's normal.
Yep.
So I think there's something around acknowledging that as well.
Yeah, and that, even when it's hard for us to believe, I mean, part of being a community is when it's hard for us individually to see hope.
Yes.
We, hopefully the community carries that for us. And I think these texts invite us to imagine what a renewed community would look like, whatever our context, what a spirit-filled community would look like. If we imagine the spirit fully at work, what might we imagine?
Yes, and the sense that Ezekiel finishes with this standing army.
Yeah.
Don't want to go down the militaristic line too far here, but that sense of anticipation that there is more to come, and as community, are we positioned in that anticipation that there's more to come?
And what is the waiting?
Yes.
We're in Lent.
We're in Lent. What is
the waiting? What is our posture in this waiting?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wonderful. Mm. Well, thank you. You've been listening to Dr. Liz Bowes from the University of Divinity. Thank you, Liz, for being here today.
My pleasure.
It's been marvellous. Thanks, Liz.
Yeah, thank you.
By the Well has been made with the support of the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College and the technical genius of Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.